Professor David Abulafia, Emeritus Professor of Mediterranean History at Cambridge University.
David, thank you very much indeed for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today. I'm going to start by asking you a question that we cover a lot on History Reclaimed. What do you think we mean by the question wokeness? You're an eminent historian, you've published many books, but wokeness, what does it mean?
To me, wokeness, which is, I admit, a rather sort of fuzzy term, but what it actually means to me is a way of sort of moralizing about society. It's a whole ideology which turns on certain concepts of human relations rooted in history over the last 500 years or so. And these are concepts which turn on the themes of colonialism, imperialism, racism, capitalism, lots of other isms. But all the time I'm uneasy about them because whenever you look at them, you say to yourself, well, what is really meant, for instance, by capitalism? Capitalism can convey so many different meanings. Karl Marx was aware of that. I'm not a Marxist, but Marx was a very scholarly individual, and he was very careful to define his terms. So part of the problem with wokeness is actually a lack of definition. But underlying all of this, there is this sort of moralizing viewpoint which is entirely negative about the history of Western civilization. That's one part of it. And another part of it is that it's rooted in this dualism, if you like, the contrast between people with white skins and people with black skins. It's very much bound up with ideas of race. Another aspect of this is therefore that when we talk to woke people or about wokeness, we have to be aware that the words that they're using may not have quite the meaning that we would normally attach to them. The concept of racism is actually rather different from what most of us would say is racist behavior, for instance. That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about something which they regard as structural throughout Western society, and particularly in the society of the United Kingdom.
Now, that's a full explanation of wokeness, but it gets bandied about to create conflict, doesn't it, between traditional historians and those who want to rewrite history to say that imperialism was bad. Isn't it apposite for each generation to rewrite history? Doesn't it lead to a kinder society if we're saying we reject these values of the past? They weren't good, they exploited people, and now we want to move forward. So let's clutch on to a new set of values.
I think the problem here is attaching values. I think you're quite right when you say that we can look at the past and we can say, I mean, we can say of all past societies pretty well that slavery in one form or another was part of the way that they functioned. We can point to all sorts of quite extraordinary behaviour by rulers who, you know, would mobilise hundreds of thousands of slaves to build pyramids or whatever it might be. Most of the monuments that we see, that we rejoice in, the Alhambra in Granada and so on, were built by slaves. Now, the point is that we don't actually attach our own values to the way that we describe this. We don't, as historians, say, and all of this was bad. We observe what was going on. We describe what was going on. We might sometimes have to describe extremely unpleasant, ugly incidents, you know, the Mongol massacres in 1258 in what's now Iraq, that sort of thing, where hundreds of thousands of people are killed quite mercilessly. And of course we know that that does not match our own ethical criteria. The difficulty that arises is really when we actually, as historians, sometimes want to say how horrible something like the Atlantic slave trade was, the experience of those being taken across the Atlantic on board ship and all sorts of other aspects, or how horrible the experience of those who suffered persecution under the Nazis or under Soviet rule or whatever. Those were awful experiences. I think a historian is entitled to interject, to say en passant, well, these are terrible things. But the historian then has to make it quite plain that he or she is drawing a line around that comment. It's a comment in brackets where you occasionally, the author allows him or herself to appear in the text. There's nothing wrong with that, in my view. But as long as it is clearly marked out as something which is an expression of opinion. Because what we actually need to be doing is trying to make contact, difficult though it is, unpleasant though it often is, with the values of past times. And in doing that, we have to set aside our own likes and dislikes. I mean, there are issues like the history of cannibalism, attempts to show that in the Caribbean at the time of Columbus, there weren't any cannibals. Well, cannibalism is an extremely distressing subject. But on the other hand, you know, the evidence does pile up, and we mustn't allow our own reaction to the phenomenon or our own attempts to diffuse the situation by denying it even existed. We have to look at this from, if you like, a inverted commas scientific approach.
And so that would be objective. And is that what you object to in how history is being told by what is called the woke brigade, that they are just putting forward their likes and dislikes rather than adopting a more objective view of history? And some might call it an evidential view of history.
Yes, I mean, it's impossible for a historian to be totally objective. We know that. We are, of course, conditioned by the attitudes of our own time. And you can often feel when you read a book, I mean, I would always tell pupils, look at the preface, see what the author says about him or herself. Look at the back flap. Very often, you know, you'll have on a Penguin book or something, you'll have a short biography. You need to know that about the author. It's quite interesting when you talk to a student and you say, oh, so you read that book. Now, remind me, who was the author? And the student says, oh, I don't know. No, the author needs to know that as much as the student needs to know the title of the book, the contents of the book. It's really important to identify these people. Of course, we are all influenced by the circumstances in which we live. And, you know, a German historian writing in the 1930s may not be a Nazi, but he might well have been influenced by all sorts of theories about eugenics and so on, which we would no longer hold today. So that's an important side of it, that objectivity is what we can strive towards, but it's not something that we can actually achieve. Now, when it comes to wokeness, we are dealing with preferences. It's not just, if you like and dislike. There's a political program here. There's an ideology. It's a rather peculiar ideology because it seems to have grown in some way out of a sort of post-Marxist, neo-Marxist way of looking at the world. But it's diverged in all sorts of ways from anything that I think Marx would have approved of. So within this ideology, there's a whole critique of Western society. If you look at some of the books that have been written, they don't offer an alternative view about how Western society could be constructed. It's all very negative. It's all about the sins of our fathers, grandfathers, great-grandfathers going back, as I say, 500 years. It's a question of a sort of original sin that has fallen on the shoulders of white Europeans, and particularly British people, because we were the pioneers of the Industrial Revolution, etc. And it's an original sin that can't be shaken off. Now, Christian doctrine does, after all, through the exercise of baptism, it does sort of cancel out original sin. In a way, it's not so much like that original sin. I have to say the analogy that came to mind, it's a very distressing analogy, but it does remind me of that sort of idea which used to circulate, and in some parts of the world still circulates, this idea all Jews are damned because they are descended from the killers of Christ. It's that sort of thing, something which cannot be eradicated across the generations. Now, no sensible person thinks that nowadays, and the church has certainly denounced that sort of view. But it's something which really places an enormous burden of guilt on all of us, as if all of us were descended from slave owners, plantation owners who had big estates in Barbados, etc., etc. But the truth of the matter is that most British people, most white British people, are descended from people who probably as children worked in the mines in the most awful conditions, or in the dark satanic mills, or were sent to workhouses because their family had completely run out of resources. That is actually the history of our society. It's not a society built entirely upon the wealth of everybody right across the social spectrum. Of course it isn't. And I think it's actually rather offensive, the way that it's assumed that everybody is actually, as it were, a modern-day descendant of plantation owners. It's simply not true. But it's bound up with this sort of moralising view of the West as totally corrupted by its original sin of the enslavement of Africans.
If we move on, and that was eloquently put, but let's consider then what you've just said and the toppling of the Colston statue, which I think is still going through various debates as to whether it should be put back up and what sign you might put near it. But do you think a wrong has been done by those who toppled the Colston statue?
Well, it's an interesting question, because I think one does have to make a distinction here between the fate of the statue, what should be done with the statue in the future, and the way...
They've taken it out of the river, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they have. They put it in the M Shed, which is this big, rather impressive museum in Bristol, largely dedicated to maritime history. And so it's still there. It's broken. It's got red paint over it. And they now say that's part of the story of the statue, which in a way it is, of course. But there's a difference between the debate about removing the statue or attaching plaques to the statue, setting out the negative side of his career alongside the positive, which was that he was a benefactor of Bristol. But, you know, you could argue that the negative side is pretty devastating. And yet, what actually happened was an act of violence. It was a criminal act. People are before the courts, so perhaps one shouldn't comment too much about that. But the way that this was done, the sort of, if you like, revolutionary character of the act of toppling the statue without going through due process, seems to me very disturbing. It's what one hopes will not continue to happen, but there have been, of course, all sorts of other examples. There's a statue of Columbus in Berkeley Square in London. I must admit, I hadn't realised it was even there, because most of these statues, people don't even notice. You just walk past them. You're vaguely aware there's a statue. You don't stop to think who it is. Columbus is there because of the American Embassy, which used to be there. And on Columbus Day this year, 14th of October, was it 12th of October? Anyway, Columbus Day this year, it was dabbed with paint. And again, this isn't the way to protest against these figures. In any case, Columbus wasn't quite the figure that these people imagined that he was. Now, Colston's acts, on the other hand, there is obviously a question. Does one want the statue to be out there in the open? What about the naming of schools and other institutions after Colston? And on this, I think one just has to bear in mind that the woke activists are not doing themselves a favour. In a sense, if they want to draw attention to these acts in the past, of which now, obviously, we do disapprove, but as I say, as historians, we don't engage in sort of moralising when we write about these things. But if we want to make people aware of these acts in the past, we should actually leave these people, these statues, etc., in place. Because the whole point is that when you remove the statue, when you remove all reference to the person in question, I mean, take Codrington, whose library at All Souls College, Oxford, one of the great glories of Oxford, take his name away, and people will know even less about Codrington than they did before. Leave him in place with an explanation of who he was, and you actually are perpetuating the memory of the bad things as well as the good things, because these people were benefactors, as I say. And actually, Codrington's record is not as entirely negative as many people have assumed. So I would say leave these things. The retain and explain policy, which the government has announced, is, I mean, in those three words, you can't say very much. It's the right direction, but it does leave you still wondering what the balance is going to be between the positive and the negative. And in attempts to do this, for instance, in Oxford, the plaque attached to the front of the building where the Rhodes statue is, it does lay too much emphasis, it seems to me, on the negative. I'm not saying that Rhodes was a delightful person. I'm not saying that he was the fount of great sort of humanity towards his African subjects. But the balance within the description of Rhodes' career has shifted so much towards the negative that I think people would go away not really having much of an impression of who this person really was. That's the important thing. And to understand also that when you're dealing with these figures, I mean, take King Edward I or Simon de Montfort, both of them, their actions against the Jews in medieval England, in the case of Simon de Montfort, actually sort of authorising a pogrom in London. This is something which, of course, nowadays we find deeply distasteful. But at the same time, we have to recognise that this is not an explanation of the whole of their career. There were other things. The reason that they're commemorated by statues outside Parliament or wherever is actually to do with other things, notably actually the history of Parliament. And there are myths about them, I mean, whether they really did found the English Parliament or not. But one has to get these things into proportion, even when dealing with extremely ugly incidents in the past.
David, can I just put the converse view? Because I was educated in the 60s and 70s. As were my friends. I had a friend who went to Balliol College in Oxford and got sent down. He became the Labour leader of Cambridge City Council, Simon Sedgwick Jell. But he got sent down from Balliol because he spray painted all the portraits in the college because he didn't agree with portraits. Isn't this just something the younger generation does? Do you think that, in a way, the reaction to wokeness is an overreaction? That this is what happens down the generations?
Well, I would have said that perhaps a couple of years ago, but in fact what we're looking at is the all-pervasive influence of these ideas within universities, within humanities departments, social science departments. That's where the woke activists are most visible. And drawing in the student body, to some extent it's generated by students, but to some extent also by academics who talk this language, this jargon-loaded language, which sounds attractive to some of the young. It's intimidating because it doesn't allow for a reasoned response. We've seen this again and again with people who've tried to resist and have then been cancelled. So this whole question, this term cancel culture, is quite relevant here, because we are looking at not just the removal of statues of people in the past, but we're also looking at the effective, if you like, abolition, I wouldn't use the word extermination, but of living people who are just sort of taken out of the record, not allowed to promote their books or to act on stage or whatever it might be. So there is this really dangerous effect that it's pervading society beyond the universities. It's spread across from the American university system to the English university system. It's spread into areas like museums, all sorts of public institutions, and it's also spread into the school system. So if children are educated only to think in these terms, then we end up with a monolithic worldview, which, in my view, is based on profound errors about understanding the past, and which is also predicated on the assumption that any other view is infused with racism, imperialism, colonialism, etc., which doesn't seek to engage in debate with other people. So what we actually need to do, again and again, we have to promote debate between the devotees of critical race theory and all these other theories that underlie woke activism and people with, if you like, more traditional views. We actually have to oblige these people to engage. And this is why also some of these arguments in defence, including a bill going through Parliament in defence of free speech, all of this is so important. Because to have universities, which ought to be the beacons of free speech, limiting freedom of speech, whether it is through undergraduates protesting against visiting speakers, or whether it is people right at the top, vice chancellors downwards, banning various people from coming to speak in the university, none of this is acceptable. There are limits, clearly. There are limits which are laid down by the law. Clearly, somebody who turns up in university and gives a speech which adds up to racial incitement, that is actually in breach of the criminal law. It's not that free speech has no boundaries. It does have boundaries, but those boundaries are far, far wider than the boundaries that woke activists imagine.
It's dangerous, then, in your view. But what about how the slave trade is now portrayed? Because was there something more evil about the Atlantic slave trade than slave trade that was happening in indigenous cultures throughout the world?
It's an interesting question because there are features of the Atlantic slave trade which never cease horrifying us. The treatment of the slaves even before they reach the coast, when they're being sort of forced to march great distances across the African, just sort of hot African territories towards these ports, El Mina and other ports on the coast of Ghana, and then put on these ships in really appalling conditions, taken across to America, and then their treatment, whether it's in the Caribbean, Brazil, where the largest number went, or in North America. It is a horrifying story. And yet, when you actually look at the slave trade in other parts of the world, you discover that, well, slavery has taken so many different forms, but there certainly have been examples of enslavement which compare, and actually one that one tends to forget about. You've got the Soviet gulags, you've got the Nazi concentration camps, where the purpose of enslavement, certainly under the Nazis, was, if possible, to work people to death. Now, there was some of that, it has to be said, also in the Americas, the idea that it was possible to replace slaves very easily, so work them extremely hard for 8 years or so, by which time they'll have worn out and died. And it is an appalling story. But it isn't the only story of slavery. Every society, really, in the past, as I said earlier, has some sort of history of slavery. I'd be interested to hear about a society that really didn't have that, at least since the Paleolithic period, since the Old Stone Age. I mean, it's something which is just written into the history of conflict, enslavement, everything that followed from that. And if we look at the history of Africa, there is, of course, a history of African kings going to war with one another, enslaving neighbouring peoples, and using those enslaved neighbouring peoples as, if you like, cash with which to buy brass and other objects from the Europeans. So there's a complicity there. It's not just a question of Europeans exploiting Africans. It's also inevitably a question of Africans exploiting Africans. It's a question too, of course, and this is the more positive side, of Europeans who developed a conscience about what they saw happening. It took a while for this to develop. Even Las Casas, the great 16th century defender of the rights of the American Indians, took him a long time to realise that replacing the dead American Indians with black slaves from Africa was only perpetuating the sorts of evils that he'd observed in what he called the Spanish Indies. So the gradual development of a sort of conscience about what was happening to slaves was something which has that sort of positive side to it as well, that actually there was developing an idea in Western society that this universal institution of slavery might actually be morally wrong. And to us nowadays, of course, the idea that we could own another person is something which, I mean, I would say just incomprehensible to me, the idea that I could be said to own another person. But it's taken a great many millennia for human society to achieve an awareness of that. And of course, we still have the exercise of modern slavery, workers in the Gulf. We have the trafficking of sex workers from Eastern Europe towards Western Europe. All of that is also part of a continuing history of enslavement.
And so we should recognise that when, for instance, we give back objects that we've supposedly looted from other countries when we were imperialist rulers of those countries. The history isn't told with enough finesse.
One of the real problems in addressing this debate from a historical perspective is the lack of nuance or finesse, absolutely, that one is given these sort of big generalizations about the nature of the slave trade. One's now being argued that the abolitionists themselves were just guided by economic considerations, all that sort of argument which is being pressed nowadays. What we need to introduce into this debate is precisely that. It's finesse, it's nuance. And when we look at the way in which woke activists portray the history of the last 500 years, they really lack any sense of these subtle distinctions that have to be made. When we look at the role of the abolitionists, when we look at the ways in which European states building their empires acted according to all sorts of very different criteria, had very different sorts of ambitions. The Portuguese were much more interested in setting up trading stations. The Spaniards set up a large territorial empire. You look at each example and you find very different conceptions of what they're doing. And you also find, of course, in the case of the British Empire in particular, you do find people arguing that empire in, let's say, India was to the benefit of the Indians. Whether you actually want to agree with that is another matter. I mean, there we get into a debate which is not, I mean, it's partly a historical debate, but it's also about various sort of ethical issues. Were we bringing civilization to these countries, or were we actually destroying their own civilization? We can have an interesting debate about that. The problem is that at the moment, I don't think we can have a debate because woke activists don't want to enter into debate. They know the answers. The answers are predetermined. And the history sort of follows from the ideology.
So that leads me, David, to our last question. Is history important to woke ideology?
I think it lies at the core, actually, of a very important area of woke ideology. I mean, woke ideology encompasses many sorts of issues, many of which I'm sure we would be quite sympathetic to, like the treatment of disabled people and so on. But at the heart of a lot of the debates is the question of critical race theory, the idea that Western society is built on a sort of capitalist racist exploitation of particularly the peoples of Africa, but also on a wider global scale. If racism is rooted in 500 years of contact between Europeans and peoples across the world, yes, then history lies at the very centre of critical race theory. But what I'd just like to stress to conclude is that critical race theory is a theory with a capital T. They sometimes just call it theory. It's a theory. It's not something which is a sort of concrete, proven scientific fact. It is simply a way of interpreting the world. And theorists have to understand that there are dozens of other ways of interpreting the world, ranging from Marxism to more, if you like, sort of capitalist approaches. But the theorists have to understand that other people also claim to have answers, and they don't wish to impose their answers in the sort of Orwellian way that race theorists nowadays seem to do.
David, thank you for taking us so meticulously through history and why you support and help set up the History Reclaimed website. Should we just give a plug for your last book and what you're moving on to write about now?
Yes, my last two books, actually, I'll mention them together because one was a history of the Mediterranean called The Great Sea, and the other one a history of the oceans, so excluding the Mediterranean, called The Boundless Sea. That's the more recent one. And now what I'm trying to do is produce a much thinner third volume, which is going to deal in an interesting way, I hope, with some of the seas I haven't looked at before, like the Black Sea. And, well, it's going to be called Seven Seas, so I won't give a list of what all seven seas are, but some rather intriguing examples. And I want to include in that some sort of reflections on the way in which the sea has played such an important role in the development of human civilization.
Thank you very much indeed, David, for talking to the History Reclaimed podcast series today. We're very lucky to have you as a guest. Thank you.
Thank you very much.